This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 385 for July 14 of 2017, tearing into the Chevy Bolt EV. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us on After Hours, and including you. I seem to remember your name. I'm pretty sure you're Gary Vasilash.
Indeed.
I haven't seen you in weeks now.
It's been a while. So I was thinking about more than a year ago, we were in Imperial Beach, California, and we did a show about the Elantra.
Yeah,
for those at home, it's show 317, in case you want to look it up. And it was interesting. Yesterday, I was driving the Elantra GT out in San Diego, and it's really amazing. So we did the original Elantra. Then they came out with the Elantra Echo. Then they came out last year with the Elantra Sport, now the Elantra GT. It just keeps rolling on and on and on. But that show we did was an interesting show.
Okay.
So I recommend people look at that.
Good deal. We got to let everybody know. David Welch from Bloomberg is in the house with us again.
Good to be back.
Great to have you here, man. It's been a while that you've been on the show.
I guess so. Yeah. A few months at least.
Yeah, something like that. Wow. But good having you back. And our special guest of the day, Sandy Monroe of Monroe and Associates, who is, I don't know, you've been on the show a number of times. It's got to be like number four.
It's been a big gap. I couldn't find the place.
It was the BMW i3 the last time you were on the show.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
There's a whole Bring Back Sandy fan page.
Yeah.
Hashtag Bring Back Sandy.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your latest effort, because you did a teardown on the Chevrolet Bolt, the Bolt EV, and UBS, the big banking investment firm, contracted you to do this. And, man, this thing has created a storm.
Yes, that is exactly true. So yesterday I was in London, England, and we made yet another presentation with the folks at UBS. On the Bolt, and under normal circumstances, because that was a bespoke job, that was a custom job strictly for UBS, no one was supposed to know about it. I have no idea how somebody got a hold of that report and tossed it into the internet, but they have never seen anything like it. And normally I would never talk about it, but it seems everybody's got the damn report. So I don't know what to say.
Hey, it's in the public domain now. We can talk about it.
Yeah,
I'm sure that UBS is not too unhappy, because
it depends on who you talk to. Talk to their lawyers, man. Yeah. And this is After Hours, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, okay, good. So I can be somewhat risque.
Yes.
But I'm telling you, their lawyers, cease and desist orders, They've got their whole nest typing out notes saying you got to take this down. So,
but Gary and I got copies of the report just
probably 2 days after
it came out.
Probably 2 days after we submitted our things. I
didn't know it was supposed to be secret when I got it. You know, I mean, it's,
really?
Wow.
Because it was just put out. That's what I was wondering, what you were talking about. Because the thing was widely distributed all over the world.
Well, I don't know who widely distributed it, but I know one thing for sure. It wasn't UBS. It was for their people. It was for their customers. But the good news is this has definitely put UBS on the map,
right,
as far as studies are concerned. First off, it's a damn good study, not just because we worked on it, but there were several analysts that worked on it to try and tie everything together to show the economy and the projections and on and on as far as electric vehicles are concerned.
But your study surprised them, because you came when you tore down the Chevy Bolt, you found out that it didn't cost as much to make as they had thought it was.
Yeah.
So explain, first of all, like, why did they contract with you guys? I mean, so the point was not to see how to build a Chevy Bolt. It was to learn about EVs in...
No,
figure
actually,
out how much
it wasn't that
the
at all.
Of
they,
it, right?
They said, I got a fellow named Colin from UBS, phoned up, and he said, I've heard that you guys do teardowns and reverse engineering and maybe some costing, too. I said, well, you heard correctly. And then he started the conversation. You know, we'd like to try and do something, but we're not exactly sure what we want to do yet. But it might be the Chevy Bolt. And I said, well, they're going to be hard to get because, you know, they're not really sold in Michigan and on and on and on. I was, in essence, kind of like, I don't really want to work with a bank. I don't know anything about banks. Why, you know? And the next thing I know, he was he got the basic information. The next thing I know, there's a guy named Patrick Hummel that's contacting us, and he is in charge of their research arm. And he phones up and he says, oh, I did some investigating. I found out you tore apart an i3. So I talked to my friends at BMW. They're furious at you. And so anyways, he said,
this is great. We had furious for i3, you'll be on this show. But yeah, furious for Bolt.
Yeah, exactly. So who knows? Anyways, at the end of the day, Patrick checked us out to make sure that the numbers we came up on the i3 were accurate. And they were confirmed by BMW, so that was happy. And then they said, can you buy a Bolt? We're going to buy one in Massachusetts. I said, really, that's going to be tough because this is like the middle of winter. It was the beginning of winter. And I said, that's going to be kind of tough. I don't think they're selling there yet. He says, oh, I'm sure we got one. Then he came back and says, oh, I guess we can't get one. So we have brokers, and they found one. And I said, well, we can pick it up, but it's not going to come in at the I don't know what they wrote. Was it 35,000, 37,000?
37. Yeah. 37.5.
Well, it's not going to no 37.5. We're going to have to pay about 52 to get it, and we're going to mark it up.
Why 52?
Because brokers need to make money.
Oh, okay. So it's...
See, it's everybody wants to make money nowadays. It's
plus,
like
the 37.5, $37,500, that's the base price. If you want like the level 3 plug, that's like another $800
oh, that's
on top of it.
That's more than you mean the one for DC. It's more expensive than that. It's an option that's
but
a so, little.
But you paid a broker who wasn't in California to get one there and bring it back here. Or
it was the broker I think was in California and then he shipped it to us. So it was like 50
something. Wouldn't it be cheaper
just
to fly out there, Sandy, and buy one and drive it back?
UBS is paying the bills.
200 miles. I'd have had to have 19
stops. You got to stop at night.
Holy shit. You got to be kidding me.
You got to stop at night.
See, but John is right. He's working with a bank.
A newspaper or something. Yeah. Anyway.
But you got to stop at night, Sandy. Like, you're going to sleep. Like, you know.
Do you know how long it takes to get that thing up to charge?
52,000.
With a 110?
You got killed on this
with
thing.
With a 110.
I
and
saw
that's all we had was a 110.
60 hours.
60 hours. That's correct.
What?
60 hours. 6-0. It's 8 hours if you have 220, and an hour and a half if you've got the
level.
Really,
correct.
8 hours at 220? Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah. So
it's a big battery.
I wouldn't have just.
I didn't realize
the
it was that long. I thought, okay.
I could have flown it cheaper.
That's
anyways,
true.
So
you got the car.
We got the car. So we got
like
into it,
narrative.
And you know, I hadn't too much good to say about the Volt when it first came out. We should start calling it the V and the B because
there is that.
Nobody.
Yeah.
Do you know what? There's something else. Do you know that there's no differentiation between a V and a B with the Chinese and the Japanese and the Korean? They can't tell the difference at all. There is no difference to them. Somebody better think about it. If they want to export that car, they better start calling it something else, you know, the Lightning Bolt or something like that. But not. So anyway, we got the car, and I wasn't a big fan of the Volt. I said some things that really upset the guys at GM. But they were true. I mean, the amount of money that they sunk into that thing was astronomical. When the Bolt came in, we looked at it and we said, oh, hey, a lot of this stuff is carryover or from the parts bin and stuff like that. Then we started looking at how they actually did the job. And it was a complete, here you go, LG Chem, you got it. Give us a battery. We'll give you the design for the motor. You build the motor. Build the gearbox. Oh, we want all the controllers. Everything is LG Chem, everything. And that's the way, if you want to, you know, get the price down and you want to get it out in a hurry, give it to somebody that, you know, does this on a daily basis, and that's what wound up happening. So LG and Samsung are our two favorite battery suppliers, and both of them know how to do the controllers and stuff like that. So it was I thought it was a pretty good move on GM's part. So I threw him under the bus for the V, but the B, as far as I'm concerned, I see a lot of good things. Plus, the price of the battery pack went down.
What is their price per kilowatt hour? Have you gotten down to that level?
Price per kilowatt hour.
Well, I can remember it was $145 for the cell, but your study says $207 for the pack. I mean, the cell's in the pack. And
cell cost is what everybody talks about.
Everyone talks cell cost, but you really got to talk pack.
You do have to talk pack because you.
Yeah.
And the pack cost, if I remember, from your study, was
you probably remember it better than I do. So, but anyway, yeah, we calculated everything. But the best news was we got lucky enough to talk to people at LG who wanted to find out some information on something else. They didn't have any budget to pay for it. So I said, hey, so we know that our numbers are pretty close. Nobody's going to give you the exact number, but I know that it's pretty close.
But this was a car out of the parts bin, basically, like a cruise platform, heavily modified, a lot of parts out of the bin.
Yeah.
And then they had a supplier do the entire battery.
The propulsion system. Yeah. But
power electronics, everything.
That's kind of smart, isn't it? Isn't that kind of
I'm
good idea?
It's dumb,
the big problem is that 60% of the content now, 60% of the value of the content, is LG Chem. LG Chem's got more money in it than Chevy does, GM does.
But that's pretty much true of any car these days. You know, when you and
not
I
not in one lump.
No, I would agree with that. But when we all got into the business, the car companies generated 70% to 80% of the value of a car, and they bought 20% to 30%. That's completely flipped today.
Well, except for Toyota.
Toyota still has higher.
Huge, unbelievable. Yeah, but at the end of the day, they have the biggest pot of money as well, so they can afford to do whatever they want. And who's going to argue?
Well, it depends
how
you count, too, right? Because with the Keiretsu system, they own a controlling interest in companies like Denso and Aisin and the like. So, depending on how you're counting.
Well, that's what we count. We just look at it. If they own more than 50%, then that's Toyota. I don't care. Yeah.
And then in the study, it actually says that Denso is going to be one of the companies that's going to be coming out on top in terms of the electrification of things.
Right.
So let's go back to the B car.
Yeah.
And one of the first things you found out is that, or at least UBS did, is that the cost to make these electric cars was several thousand dollars cheaper than what they thought.
Yeah, $4,000. Yeah,
$4,000 cheaper.
Yeah, and that's mainly because of the battery technology has come along. I mean, it's going to be really cheap when we get to 811. Right now, the ratio is, I think...
What's 811?
This is the cobalt?
The cobalt. If you can drop the cobalt content, I can't remember the... I don't want to guess, but if you get the report. Anyways.
They're saying if you, right now it's 811 and the plan is...
We want to go to 811.
I thought it was to go to 111.
No, because then cobalt and nickel and lithium, it'd all be the same. You want eight times of the lithium and as little cobalt as absolutely possible. So the cobalt acts like glue, and that's your safety agent. And if you can figure out how to get rid of, I don't know if you're aware of it. I didn't know this, but cobalt mostly comes from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and that's not what you'd call a great stability in political terms and whatnot. So they're going through another election, and everybody is holding their breath because that could really slow things down. Usually when they have election, they also have a revolution to go along with it. It's like, you know.
Hey, we're going to have to take a quick break in a minute. Before we do, let's get to one of the first questions that came in. Peter wants to know, how long did it take to do the teardown of the Chevy Bolt?
Well, we didn't tear down everything. We only tore down the power pack, and I would say that it was probably about three and a half months, and that was including writing the report. So they wanted it in a hurry, and we put extra folks on it.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay, look, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with Sandy talking a whole lot more about the stuff. But right now, we're going to give a shout-out to our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back with Sandy Monroe. So, David, you were asking something, all right? I think I cut you off. Yeah.
So you've torn down the i3 and the Bolt. In terms of battery pack chemistry and that sort of thing, the i3 was done a couple of years ago. Has the chemistry, has the technology advanced, has cost come down greatly? Like, what do you see then versus now in these two cars?
So when we tore down the i3, prior to tearing down the i3, I was enamored with the LG batteries. I thought they were the best on the planet. When we got the BMW i3, then all of a sudden we saw better battery chemistry. We also saw they have a better or more cost-effective battery manufacturing system than what Samsung, than what LG Chem had. Now, as far as the cost differential, there's a little bit, but not much. The big thing is going to what's really going to make a big difference, I think, is the impact of trying to get to 811. If they do that, if whoever gets to that point, or if they both get to it at the same time, then you're going to see a reduction in the amount of cost. Because although everybody worries all about lithium, there is tons of it. It's like it's a rare earth, but rare earth material, but it's not really rare.
So one of the things that came out of the report was they're talking about how there could be parity with internal combustion engines in Europe.
Yes.
Within like
next
2025.
Year? No, I thought they said 2018.
2018, but 2025 is when they think that it'll be like 50-50 or something like that.
Well, what they were saying in the 2025 is that automakers would be able to make a 5% margin
right.
on cars.
Well, that's it. As far as I'm concerned, if you can't make any real money at it, then
why you do it?
Yeah, why bother? But
is that realistic, Sandy? By 2025, you can make 5% on electric cars?
Yeah, you bet. Yeah. So that's kind of what that's really, you know, we gave them what the prices are right now. And we told them what we thought about projections on different materials and whatnot. But they went through and manipulated the numbers so that they could figure out, okay, gasoline prices are this in Europe, and the general buying population is here, and the infrastructure will be there, and blah, blah, and here we go, boom. Because if you're in the city, if you're in a major... maybe not a major city. London is going to have a problem. But if you're in a city of some size but not gigantic, an electric car is going to be wonderful for you. It'll be cheaper than gasoline or diesel fuel. The price parity as far as – and it's not price parity as in my electric car and my gas engine car are the same. It's more like the cost of ownership.
So, and that's what I should say for 2018, and that's what the report said. Total cost of ownership, TCO, would be on a par in Europe next year. And in Europe, why? Because it's still $7 a gallon for gasoline in Europe.
Exactly right. And in 2025, now you have cost parity, real cost parity. That's what they're predicting. And I kind of agree with that for Europe. In China... 2020 and 2027, I think, were the dates. And in the United States, they put something down, but it doesn't matter because it's a lie. nobody in the States is running out to buy their electric car.
What's the latest and greatest, Sandy, on how quick charge will get a battery like the Bolt fully charged?
Like the Volt? Or Bolt, rather?
Bolt, yeah.
Okay, so an hour and a half right now, if you're using a DC charge, that's the fastest.
Wow.
But if you go to a 400 volt system or a 400 volt battery, like what Porsche is doing, now you can do it in 15 minutes.
Wow.
Okay. Just don't get too close. Children, don't lick that plug. I'm telling you, you're not going to like it.
When you talked about the i3, you talked about this car in the context of almost being Model T-like and its ability to transform the industry, because as you...
No. I said technology.
Well, that's
the technology was so dramatically, and still is. Nobody's got anything like the i3. Nobody. It's just too bad. It was so ugly. If they would have made that look like a 3 Series BMW, they'd be selling us the daylights out of it.
Could they have
they
packaged
didn't.
It and made the car look... the way they want it. I mean, that's, you know, all these car, all of the cars, except for what Tesla's done, and this is why Tesla has such a great brand, they've all been kind of gawky or boring hatchbacks. The Bolt, pretty boring hatchback. i3, kind of gangly. Leaf,
Prius.
Another boring hatchback.
I mean,
the Prius has been, you know, it's a geek car.
But look at the Tesla Falcon doors. Ooh. I mean, everything about the S, people like everything that comes out of Tesla, they're looking at, that's my primary market. I have to make money on this. Everybody else, we have to have an electric car. Oh, put old dead Steve on it and get some, you know. That's not the way you want to do this. I think that, you know, what do I know? I'm not in charge of GM or Ford, but if I'm going to put something out, I want it to look red hot.
So you think they missed an opportunity with the Bolt in terms of styling and total appeal?
No, I think that the market is still slow, and probably what they did will be just fine. They didn't spend too much money on it. They used their internal parts bin and modified something that they got. They can build it on the same assembly line. It's not a new assembly line. And they put a few through, and that's kind of like what they did. It's probably something more for marketing than it is for...
It's regulation. They've got to meet the California ZEV mandate, the zero-emission vehicle rules.
Right. So Armin wrote in, he says, it was estimated that GM loses $9,000 on each Bolt it makes. Well, you found differently.
Seven grand.
Loses about $7,000 on each Bolt.
But, I mean, okay, once I got rid of my sunk costs and blah, blah, it'll start to make money. It depends. Personally, I wouldn't buy it. It's not my kind of car, and it's not pretty. So it wouldn't attract me. But there are people who will buy a Chevy. That's especially if you're, you know, you're in town. It's just fine if you don't drive.
Listen, we here have all driven the car. I think it's a fantastic car to drive.
I
love
well.
The thing.
I'll tell you what, from a drive standpoint,
yeah,
I did better than the i3 because I didn't have the thing dialed in properly on the i3. Take your foot off the gas and you went right through the windshield. Okay, that
the
really didn't make me happy.
Right,
yeah, the regen and braking was a little bit aggressive. So I like the Bolt as well, the B. I like the Bolt as well. From a driving standpoint, I drove it around a little bit. Hey, this is pretty nice. Everybody did. Nobody came back with anything disparaging. We have a thing we call the FFQ, the Fit Finish Quality Assessment. It's a non-intrusive kind of thing, and it's more geared toward subjective feelings than it is really objective analytics. And it came back with a pretty high score. It works. It does what it's supposed to do.
It is a nice car. It's
and
just,
it makes
it's a hatchback. It's a compact. You know, what is this market absolutely running from? Hatchback compacts, and you know that's why the appeal is limited. But I think you're right. I think they knew they were going to lose a lot of money on every one. I've been told nine. You know, UBS is estimating 7,500. It's kind of all in the same ballpark. It's, you know, losing a few hundred or $1,000 on a compact car is unacceptable to car makers these days. So it's a lot of money to lose per car. So they don't want to sell a lot of them because you just lose more money, but they will meet their regulations. They'll learn something. And then as battery costs come down, they'll be ready to go out with something that's, you know, bigger volume.
Do you think General Motors learned as much as BMW learned?
Well... you mean from a total technology prospect?
Mm-hmm.
No, because nobody's got anything even close in the market right now as far as technology is concerned.
To the i3.
The i3 is vastly superior from a technology standpoint to pretty much anything. But who wants to sink that kind of money? I mean, they threw billions at it. The good news is that I mean, now they're making carbon fiber for Boeing. They had one carbon fiber plant in Moses Lake. Now
State
they got a second one, and they're putting a third one right next to it. So maybe they didn't make money on the car, but I guarantee you they're making money on other things. And selling carbon fiber is one of them. Actually, did I show you guys this stuff?
No. What do you have?
Here, this is, and that's the advanced stuff. This is what it looks like before you start throwing
I've seen this out of
So this is woven carbon fiber. It looks like,
it's,
you know.
It's woven and stitched. So that's sewn together. So the stuff comes out really, really thin, and then you put a bunch of layers on it, and you weave
looks
it.
Looks like, you know, almost something that you'd put under a carpet, you know.
Yeah,
like,
shoddy.
Shoddy.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what we that's what you have. That's how the BMW i3 is made, something like that. And then it goes into RTM, resin transfer molding. But this has really got me excited. This is a sheet molded compound. Now that's got a honeycomb inside of it. But to me, that's the way to go. I would jump past this. What BMW
Well, explain
did.
The difference. So you don't take one, the shoddy and put
well, it,
RTM.
Well, it has that, but it's not as thick as this, and it's made very, very thin. Okay, and then you put the honeycomb in there, and so you have it on both sides. Now I've got a structure that's a lot stronger. Okay, so in the olden days when I was young, and you drew on a drafting board, we needed drafting boards that were huge, right? So some of them were. Mine was 4x8, okay? Yeah, 4x8. And that's a big drafting board. Well, if I put that onto the normal stands, it wouldn't take it. But we would take, you know, 1/8 plywood. We'd put a honeycomb in the center. Now, all of a sudden, the stands would be able to lift it up and down, no problem. It was lightweight and plenty strong. Never warped, never did anything. Same thing on this, only
it's really hard.
Yeah.
So you're saying make a sandwich. So you
it's
have
sandwich,
you so
yeah.
you basically have the carbon fiber material on the outside.
On both
outside,
yeah.
So like a sandwich and then right. But what is the stuff in between?
Well, that's the secret sauce. Oh. And I like I said, a lot of people come to us with technologies, and some of them want us to tell us a little bit about it. Not many of them want us to tell everything about
it. So you're not going to tell us what the honeycomb's made out of.
No.
But that's very astute. Yes, yes, yes.
So this is being used by someone or this?
Yeah.
Somebody's building.
Did you guys develop this?
Yeah, cars. They're building special sports cars with that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Is it really expensive compared to?
$47,000. And the reason that they use this.
Formula One technology.
No, it's not Formula One. $47,000 wouldn't get you a tire. But the this is being used on specialty sports cars, and they're selling for €47,000. Okay, and
you're saying the car is 47. You're saying just that's 47,000 worth of material in every
that's
car.
That's the whole car. Here's the car. Okay. 47,000 euros.
Sounds like Alpha 4C to me.
I couldn't tell you. Anyways, so at the end of the day. Somebody's doing this right now. People are doing this right now. And if we get to the VTO, vertical takeoff machines, that is what I would...
Oh, and we got to be talking about that. But we got to take another commercial break yet. And then we're going to come out of that. We've got a Dr. Data coming up as well. But I want to talk... You say vertical takeoff machines. We're talking drones. And
no.
No? Okay, okay. Well, hold it, hold it.
Okay.
Hold it, because we're going to take a break.
To pay for these guys?
Yeah. I mean, yes, you do. Actually, they pay for us, and we're going to give a shout-out to our good friends at Lear right now.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Got to be able to make them.
Okay, we're back. We're back. And this is the part of the show where Dr. Data is going to make an appearance.
Okay, so this time, the last couple times we didn't have a graphic for you guys to guess at. So as you guys may not know, I think you know, that I put a number up there and you try to determine what that number means or what it represents. So Carmen, could you please bring up the first number? So it's 1 million per day.
Ah, I know what it is.
I'm
not going to say.
Any idea what 1 million per day might be? Something happens 1 million times a day now.
Oh, it happens already. Maybe I don't know.
the UBS study gets
downloaded. downloaded 1 million times a day. All right.
Okay, let me guess.
All right.
That's going to be the number of battery cells that need to be manufactured for electric vehicles.
If only, right? And the answer is Oh. So last week, Lyft announced that it's doing 1 million rides per day.
That's a lot of rides.
And apparently Uber is doing like five times that many.
I was actually going to guess that it was Uber, but even 1 million seemed high even for Uber to me. But
yeah, so it's 1 million for Lyft per day, and they're only in the United States.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the...
What's Didi doing in China?
Well, Uber and Didi have a thing going, so I'm not sure that they
Didi
don't count
kinda bought out Uber.
Yeah, in China.
In China.
Yeah, yeah, they bought the... They had a Chinese JV, and right. And but Didi bought
so
Uber's
sort of
share.
Like
what?
So
nobody uses cabs anymore. When I go to China, I don't know if we're going to talk about that, but when we have an operation in China now, we don't use anything but Didi. We have to get our own phones because you... In order to make the bank accounts and everything work, you've got to have a Chinese phone, a Chinese bank account. And then it's kind of like you drive wherever you're going to drive to, beep, and that's it. You walk out, everything's done. I love it. It's like...
So does this replace car ownership in the U.S., Sandy? What do you think? Will Lyft and Uber, ride-sharing, ride-hailing, will that replace owning cars in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of younger people don't want to have a car, don't need a car. But I don't think... Like somebody was saying that, oh geez, we're not going to get an increase in car sales. I was surprised that we got up as high as we did. I mean, I think that there's a level that we can sell in the United States, and I think it's somewhere between 16 and 17 million. And I think that's what you're going to see as the norm. I don't think you're going to get as. In fact, I think it's going to probably diminish because kids don't care. Right. They don't care.
Yeah.
So Alex Partners did that study that they announced at the Automotive Press Association yesterday, and saying that, you know, if you're using Zipcar, that takes 19 cars out of the fleet, you know, each one of those.
Right. But only
four for Lyft or Uber. So, you know, it isn't so bad.
Yeah, their conclusion was that it will take a little bit out of new car sales, but not a lot. Because, one, you know, one of the reasons Uber and Lyft are so popular is, and every one of us travels for work, there are a lot of under-taxied cities.
Yeah.
Look,
one of them.
You're in Vegas for a convention. I've always rented a car because you'll stand outside in front of any casino for an hour waiting for a cab.
Yeah.
So an Uber or a Lyft is a much better way to go. And that's true in a lot of, San Francisco and New York had plenty of taxis, but a lot of cities, it's just, you have to call and reserve one like it's a limo, which is what Uber and Lyft are doing by app. And the old cab guy should be kicking themselves for not just hiring an app developer 10 years
ago. But, you know,
ago.
Manhattan was never under-taxied, and there's now more Uber cars in Manhattan than there are yellow cabs.
Yeah.
I think people like the convenience. I think they like using an app. There's a lot more, especially amongst millennials, who would never get caught going into a taxi Lyft and Uber all day.
Uber's a service in a lot of cities that didn't have a lot of cabs, especially for people who want to go out for a night in the town, ride to the airport, all that kind of stuff. It will replace yellow cab in cities like New York because yellow cabs in the Stonies. Who wants to stand on a busy New York street corner, compete with the other three people standing on the same corner to hail a cab, especially if there's any kind of weather? I mean, yellow cab should have come up with something like this a long time ago. The real question is, does it replace car ownership, and does that reduce auto sales overall? And after that Alex Partners presentation, I talked to their consultants, and they're, you know, we know these guys. John Hoffecker is a very smart guy, and he said, look, it's impossible to model because, yeah, some people will go from two cars in their household to one and rely on Uber and that sort of thing. But then those cars they're going to churn through the system faster because they get a lot more miles on them, and someone has to build that car. It's not like Uber and Lyft are going to build their own cars. They want nothing to do with that.
They don't even want to maintain them. Yeah. They don't want to maintain a fleet.
No.
Yeah.
So is it an opportunity, Sandy, from like an engineering of, you know, a purpose-built vehicle for things like car ride-hailing?
There's already purpose-built. I mean, you can go to a London cab, and there's a purpose-built vehicle. That would work just fine.
They have an electric car now. They announced that this week. There's an electric London cab.
Yeah, I actually saw one. Actually, not yellow cab, but black cab, they call them in London. Mm-hmm. And so I was there 2 days ago. Well, I was there yesterday, but 2 days ago we needed to get from point A to point B in a hurry. Black cab, and jump in and away you go, and it was electric. No noise.
Now, is that owned by the Chinese now?
Yeah, no clue.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a Chinese owned.
So it's not English engineered electric? cars. We know how much.
I got to tell you though, we're missing out. Okay, we talked about Uber, so I don't know who to say, but could you put the that vertical takeoff, the one that says Uber on the side? Yeah. Uber is Uber's looking for the.
So what do you make of this? Of impact on the auto industry if people start using. Okay, here it is.
Okay, so here it is. So here, this is Detroit Aircraft Company. Guess where they're located? And nobody knows about these guys.
No, who are they? They're located in Detroit?
Yeah, they're at Detroit Airport. So John Romanelli asked me to, you know, can you show this? And I said
this is like the tilt rotor, really.
Yeah, it is. It's like an Osprey or a BAE.
Yeah, the V-22.
This product has somewhere it says Uber on there.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, it says on the glass.
Oh, there it is. Yeah. Okay, so Uber is really excited about this. The guy at Uber that's running that department. Remember when I did an airplane?
I saw the
paradigm.
Yeah. So this, just so the audience knows, this was an autonomous personal aircraft.
Right. Seats five,
and you didn't have to know anything about flying. All you had to do was bring it out to taxi it out to the runway, and it would fly from there.
That's exactly right.
You did have to know how to use a parachute.
It had a parachute in it. Why bother with individual parachutes? Put one parachute, and it'd float the whole plane down. So it had everything you needed to have, right? And in 2008, when we were ready to rock with this thing, what did people say?
Oh, no pilot? Oh, that's impossible.
And now there's 1,000 feet of separation between planes. And I got people telling me, oh, they're going to smash into each other and everybody's going to die. 1,000 feet. How much now for an autonomous car? I can't even talk. I'm getting so choked up. I mean, we're looking at 2 feet. 2 feet. And you're running around at 89 miles an hour.
A lot of people may not realize, but commercial aircraft are basically autonomously flown. I mean, they can fly and land themselves. I mean, the pilots are doing the work, but they can.
So you're
they do,
so
actually.
That thing we're looking at. What I mean, so what's the plan?
That's the paradigm. Right there. That was the we bought. We put a
Chevy V8.
Yeah,
it was a Corvette engine.
Corvette engine. And we got that thing to actually. That thing actually would take off without any problems. We needed 750 pounds of thrust. We had 1,000, and that thing was only kicking up at around, I think it was like 3,200, 3,300 RPM. So you know what? That engine's going, are we going to ever get going? You know?
Really?
Yeah, seats five. It was a fabulous idea. Trouble was, nobody was. I used to tell people, you know, when I was a kid, I went down to Hudson's, and they had a guy that ran the elevator because it was too dangerous for anybody to just push the button. So at the end,
I still believe
now,
that, but
now we're looking at. Yeah,
you should see him sweating in an elevator.
He doesn't go to Hudson.
It's embarrassing. I won't even ride an elevator with him.
So anyway, these aircraft, these new ones, these new VTOs, they got the same thing. Okay, they are exactly the same, and there's some flying already.
But you don't need runways.
I mean, don't need anything
because it's a VTOL.
I can drop it down in your backyard as long as you don't have a swimming pool or something. I can drop it down in your backyard. That seats five or six, and you get in. Uber says, "Oh, you got a big party and you want to go to Chicago." See, if we go back to that thing, that's another one. This is the one that's in Germany. Okay, these are another form of VTOL. They're also electric. Both those planes are electric. One has 8 motors. One has, I think, 40 or 50. I can't remember. But at the end of the day, you're looking at the future there. Battery electric, yes.
Really?
Well, you can't have an extension cord, John.
I know.
It's just too long.
Well, I know, but I was wondering if it would be hydrogen. You know,
just
fuel cell.
That would be even better. But right now, nobody's.
It's one of those garden hose things.
Actually, if someone would pay us to do an analysis on the Toyota, I bet you we could figure out how to make, because my guess
take
is
take the Mirai fuel cell and stick it in one of these VTOLs.
So
attention banks, Sandy is ready.
Yeah, attention banks. Actually, no, A2MAC 1 and I were going to do it. A2MAC 1 is sometimes a competitor and sometimes not, but we were going to do it. They had it torn one apart, and we started looking at it, and we went, oh my God, if I had it right from the beginning, I could have probably done it. But there was it was taken apart too deep, and we just passed. Well, looked at how well I did on the I-3 and said, screw it. So, but that would be a better route to take because it's lighter, a much, much lighter package.
Well, Geely just bought the flying car company.
Yeah, Terrafuga.
Oh,
I was going
right?
to bring.
I didn't know that.
Well, yeah, Terrafuga just went. So guess what? My guys are all. We always go to Oshkosh, and now the two head guys from Geely that are in charge of everything, but kind of like interested in Terrafuga, they're coming with our lady that runs the president of Monroe. China, she's bringing them to Detroit, and then Sid Siddiqui, one of my guys, he's going to take them in his commander and fly them to Oshkosh.
So this is the Experimental Aircraft Association annual wacky plane thing.
The biggest fly-in in the world. Like you go from Oshkosh, which has got, 80 people or something, to about 750,000. It's big, huge.
Where's the big one?
That's Oshkosh.
Oh.
Because there's so many people flying in, the population grows unbelievably.
Oh, I see what you mean.
I'm not kidding you when I said 750,000. It's a huge fly-in. And every type of plane you could ever imagine. Some of them are kind of wacky, but there's every World War I, World War II, Korea, any kind of war, if it flew... There's one of them there.
So I mean, given the fact that Geely is bought, those guys started in Massachusetts or something like that, Terrafuga, and out of MIT, I think. And
yeah,
I mean, does this give you hope that there will be flying cars?
Personally, I really never bought into Terrafuga because the wings fold up and they go beside the car and.
It's a bad plane, and it's a bad car.
There's a lot of things I've got to try and get through NISHTA, and I've got to try and get through the FAA. And I don't see either one of them being real happy about anything. So to me, we can help them so they can actually produce it, and probably we change things. But for me, the VTO is the right way to go. It's electric, number one, and I can get it to go 200 miles an hour. And I could probably easily get, 500 miles out of the thing, something like that. I mean,
How high do those fly, Sandy?
Huh?
How high do those fly?
Actually, you'd pass out before, because they're not pressurized. So if you get above 17,000 feet, I don't know why you'd want to do that anyway, because it's made for... short takeoff and landings. Right. You want to be in a city like I see New York, fabulous opportunity. Any of the big cities with a lot of flat roofs,
and a lot of traffic
and a huge amount of traffic. Yeah, New York
car traffic.
I forgot how bad things are in New York and London. I haven't been to London or New York for a long time. Normally, I get up real early, get to where I need to get to, spend all day there, and then. By 10 o'clock we're leaving, and so I don't see it. But this trip, we were in the middle of New York, and it's like unbelievable. That's the perfect opportunity for making a tremendous amount of money. So if I was going to put my money someplace, if somebody said, well, do you want to make an electric car? No. Do you want to make a car that looks like an airplane or an airplane that looks like a car? No. What about doing a fuel cell? No. But if somebody come along and said, hey, how about we make a vertical takeoff that will bring people from point A to point B and no pilot is required, where do I sign? Because if I can make that work, I will make a whole new market, and I will kick the daylights out of everybody else. I think, personally, it won't happen in the U.S., but I think, right now, I can't really talk about all of them. Okay, so Geely, it's in the press. But there's four other companies in China that are already doing this. Four. So Geely makes five. How many in the U.S.? Because we're the technological leaders. Right after somebody else does it and gets it running, we will be right there. I guarantee it. We will be right there. We'll be, as they used to say at a company I once worked for, we will be second and better dressed. Okay. Yeah, tell me another.
Okay, I want to pick up more on this thread, about why the U.S. isn't as aggressive as it used to be in these kinds of things. But we got to take another break here. We're also going to look at a walk around that Gary just did with Hyundai's Sonata GT, right?
No, this is the Sonata. So we'll be with the chief designer of the Sonata.
Okay. I'm getting my cars mixed up. But all first, right. Going to take a quick break right now and take a look at BorgWarner.
BorgWarner, developing advanced technologies specifically aimed at reducing emissions, increasing fuel economy, and improving performance. Our award-winning innovations extend from turbocharging and cooling systems to friction materials and diesel cold start technology. Built on a century-long reputation of innovation and reliability, we have the track record that proves our technology can help meet the challenges of the commercial truck and off-highway industry.
Okay, hold on. We'll get back to that number in a minute. But, Gary, we were just talking about you were out on the West Coast.
So then the day before yesterday, I was in Julian, home of the famous pie company that everybody goes and eats pie at in Julian. And so we had the opportunity to do a walk around of the major mid-cycle refresh of the Sonata. They basically have taken all the sheet metal and changed it to try to amp up interest in the mid-size sedan you were talking about. Compacts having problems. Sedans are having problems as well. As you've said many times in the show, it's all about crossovers now as far as the market's going. So this is their attempt at Hyundai to re-energize their midsize.
Their sedan. Okay, let's take a look.
We're here in Julian, California with the 2018 Hyundai Sonata and the chief designer for the studio based here in California, Chris Chapman. Chris, thank you very much. Now, you guys competed for the design of this car. You won for the design of this car. I want you to tell me the three things that are the coolest aspect of this.
Well, it's a team effort. We always know that, right? But I would say beginning with the major refresh, you're always sort of focusing on the front end and the rear end of the car, but it actually is a great opportunity to kind of get a stance going on. So I'd say number one is the stance of the vehicle. It's sort of this runner out of the block, the sprinter out of the block, and it's especially frozen as soon as the gun shoots off when they jump out and their head turns up. And so what we've done is we've extended the hood of the car in the nose area here by quite a significant aesthetic amount in order to bring that nose a little bit more prominently forward and give it a more assertive kind of a feel.
Swept back before.
It was swept back before, now it's more upright. And that in conjunction with the rear end, which we'll get to in a second, is leaned forward. It gives that sort of sprinter's kind of face.
Okay.
The second area is it's a major refresh in the front end of the car, and it begins with our new Cascade grille. We used to have a hex grille that we've had for a long time. Continuing on with the evolution of the fluidic sculpture themes that Hyundai has been known for, we have this sort of Cascade grille that comes around from the top of the grill around and then does this sort of chicane or this S curve down to the lower part of the vehicle. And at the bottom of the vehicle, we have this sort of catamaran line that kind of lifts and levitates and lightens up the front.
So you've taken a classic design cue that we've come to know from Sonata and accentuated it with some...
Bring it into the future, okay. Right? A little more motion.
So there's a character line running along the body side here that you have a particular nomenclature for. Tell us about it.
Well, I call it the Saber line. It's coming from the previous generation, et cetera. It's quite an energetic line. Usually you see it from front three-quarter, but it's really sort of the Saber line where it's this lunge forward, and as soon as a Saber makes contact with an object, the Saber sort of bends, right? And so we have this wonderful kind of sculptural line there. That in conjunction with this classic Sonata chrome detail that goes through the belt line, through the hood cut, and into the headlight. The two lines together sort of juxtapose once against one another and form a nice little dynamic.
So as we come back to the rear of the vehicle, the rear quarter, tell us about what you've done here.
Well, it's a real four-door coupe kind of a line. The C-pillar extends all the way to the rear of the vehicle. It touches down right here, accentuating a really short deck lid and a six-window configuration to the DLO, ending really at the back of the rear tire, and it really brings an elegant line to the car.
And it helps move everything forward.
Right.
So this deck lid is an entirely different interpretation of what you've done before.
Yeah, we really cleaned up the rear end of the car. It's most notable is when we moved the license plate from this area right here, which is kind of a typical architecture, down to the lower part of the car. Cleans up the area. What I like to have is, on my cars that I design, really undisturbed sheet metal. Mm-hmm. So we've just got the badge in a wonderful sculpted area with the nomenclature here, very thin, slim taillight lines, and it really kind of helps bring an accentuated harmony like what we have in the front of the car in that sort of broken down third kind of power line.
Thanks, Chris, for your explanation of what you've done to the 2018 Sonata design.
All my pleasure.
Interesting, Gary. So what do you think of the car overall?
I can't tell you.
Oh, it's still under embargo.
But what's very interesting, one of the things they did was, so for the rear camera, they've put it down just above the license plate holder. So there is no, you know, how clean it looked back there.
Yeah.
And you also notice that there was no, you know, nowadays nobody has a lock cylinder in a trunk, right? And so it's all push button. But in the H, there's an area that you can touch.
H of the Hyundai.
The H of the Hyundai, which I learned was supposed to be two people shaking hands. That's the
design of the logo.
Yeah.
Yeah, you told me that earlier, and I was like, what? I never heard that.
Who knew that? So, anyway. It's an interesting car. They've spent a lot of money on that mid-cycle refresh. It sort of reminds me of, remember when we had the chief engineer of the Camry in here when they did that, you know, like changed every sheet metal part except for the hood,
yeah,
you know, as a mid-cycle. And I think these guys are doing the same sort of thing.
Well, you know, Camry, and then tomorrow Honda showing off the complete redesign of the Accord.
Right.
So, yeah, everyone's scrambling to try to preserve their passenger car sales with new designs.
What do you think? Passenger car is going to?
Yeah, I think that's going to continue. Look, I think all the companies have to figure out how to make, you know, Honda already does it pretty well, but you've got to make something in that plant, on that assembly line, other than a midsize sedan, because demand is just going to keep going down, and you've got to be able to make crossover SUVs or minivans or you know, combination of things off of that platform, or you're in big trouble. Because it's, look, I like passenger cars. This is all good for me. The next time I go to buy a car, I'm going to get a $5,000 rebate on whatever I want. But look, I think there's a bigger issue with this whole trend of going to crossover SUVs, especially as you get into autonomy and stuff like that. First of all, crossover SUVs are not fun to drive. They're better than the old, you know, a 98 Ford Explorer in terms of ride and handling, but they're still not fun to drive. And if you think that midsize sedans from 50 feet away all look the same, crossover SUVs, you take a BMW and a Hyundai of the same size class, from 20 feet away they look the same. This is really commoditizing the automobile. So when autonomy gets here, this is something the car companies, why do I want to, you know, if you want to combat losing customers to pure ride sharing, there's got to be something special about owning your car and being in it. And if it's just a two-box crossover SUV with a 2.4-liter engine in it, you know, they all bore me to death. And I think they do. People like them because they're practical and you can fit a lot of stuff in them, which is great. But it's a total commodity, these vehicles.
Very true. Couldn't agree more.
Mm.
Hey, as I said before the break there, Sandy, you guys do great work at Monroe & Associates, and the Chinese are all over your company. They want all kinds of stuff for you to do for them. And it sounds to me like you don't get a whole lot of work out of American companies.
That's an issue, I guess. Most of our work is European, or it's Chinese. Very, very little is coming out of the U.S., very little. Now, that might change a little bit because we just got a big contract from one of the local guys. But for the most part, China is huge. Japan is getting bigger. And in Europe is big for us. But China is our biggest market. Actually, there's a little slide that shows our new place we're going to be taking it over in
What, you're moving to a new building?
Didn't you just
moved into a giant building?
No, but in China.
The China one. So the other two buildings are that we already have those, but the China one is spectacular. I didn't bring a lot of slides, but inside, these guys are giving it to us for 3 years for free. We have the first floor, so we got about 24,000 square meters. It's about 24,000 square feet. If it's a square meter, just add a zero and call it a foot. So it's about 24,000 square feet.
That's big.
And it's relatively big. But one of the guys over there who would be normally considered a competitor is asking, because there's a great big giant elevator that would get us up to the second floor. They're trying to get us to get the second floor as well, because with the work that they're looking at, and there's the right ceiling heights and whatnot, they're really excited about it. But they're going to turn that thing into a bit of a palace for us. So, I mean, the floors are marble, or granite, I should say. I couldn't believe it. The walls are also going to be granite. They showed us the conference rooms and the restrooms and whatnot. This looks like a 5-star hotel, not a.
So what are you going to be doing in this place? I mean,
same thing as here.
But I mean, not just all about tearing apart cars.
No, we're going to do. Most people know us about benchmarking and costing and things like that. But we also do a lot of new product development. So a lot of stuff I just can't talk about. But one thing I can talk about is club car. We analyzed that car. We designed that car. We did everything on that car.
The golf car.
The golf car. Yeah. So that thing was 100% Monroe and Associates. Not 100%, but pretty close to 100% Monroe and Associates. We did everything to bring that thing to market. Came in making a lot of money. Quality was astronomically higher than any other golf car, and it actually drove. I mean, it didn't feel like you were in that little red wagon you had when you were a kid, you know, being pulled along over a bumpy road. It was tough. This one had an actual suspension and whatnot. And it's still out there, and it still kicks the daylights out of the marketplace. It's still the golf car to buy. The other guys, one of them had much bigger market share. They're almost out of that business completely. So we can do a good job, and we've done that with aircraft, and we've done it with medical devices and whatnot, where we will do a new product development for somebody using our.
So you guys have process knowledge, yeah, and
right,
engineering knowledge, right, and are able to bring these things together.
Right. And usually when somebody's got something where they don't have enough time to get the job done, they're dillying around or they don't have enough money, it's cheaper for us to do it than it is for them to do it. That's one of the main reasons why Club Car hired us. They did an internal study to find out how much it was going to cost and how long it was going to take, and we beat that so that we got the job. Same thing with medical devices and other things, especially nowadays with medical devices. The Obama regime was not good for the medical industry. That's why you see almost everything pulled out. Most of California medical device companies, they've all buggered off. They've either shut down their engineering and they'll buy it from someplace else, or they've moved it to one of their offshore locations, like Costa Rica is a good spot for doing that sort of stuff now. But California took a mighty whack when all the rules and regulations came out under Obamacare. Hmm. Yeah, you don't hear too much about that, but that's one. But we work on pretty much anything, and that's what they want us to do or help them with in China. They want us to help them get to the point where they can produce a car or anything else for that matter, but primarily it's focused on cars. How do we get, a Class A kind of car out the door faster?
So
how do
John's we make point, why are you not hearing this from the U.S.? I mean,
well, we're much smarter here. We don't need Sandy Monroe. Actually, that's what usually I get. Why would we want to go to you? We have thousands of engineers. We don't need you. And that's true. They do have a lot of engineers. But if you want to have something different in the marketplace, and all you're doing is looking at other people in your marketplace, and you get into something we call engineering incest. Okay, so I don't want to throw rocks, but that grill work, did it remind you of another car? No, we can't say anything bad, because if we did that, we'd be insulting someone, and that's unfortunately the way things are in the auto industry. Everybody copies. In the old days, they'd make commercials to tell you not to do that. That people are stealing their stuff. Nowadays,
Audi goes right across. This one goes down. So,
okay, look, we're down to the very end here, but we got some good questions from the. I'm sorry, but we got to get to this. We got to get to it because okay. We've gotten some really good questions from the audience here, and we're going to have to do this rapid fire. Cameron Sauer says, "Heard anything about structural foams?"
Yes, we have tons and tons of different types of structural foams. If we can get them to keep from catching on fire, that's the big thing. But we use them all over the place on military products.
Okay, Al-Qaeder 1 says, another thing I like better on my Bolt than the i3 is that the i3 carbon fiber got really hot in the sun and took forever to cool down.
That's because it's got the air conditioning system for the Bolt, for the cab, and for the cooling of the batteries is the same system, and I think it was undersized.
Hmm. We got a phone call here, too. Carmen, let's bring that in. Dan from Georgia.
Georgia.
Hi, this is Dan in Georgia. I was wanting to ask Sandy about the cost of the electronics in the EVs and how he sees that coming down in the next few years. It seems that that's a higher cost of what an EV is than a regular internal combustion car. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, one of the main reasons why things are so expensive is because everything's been individualized. So your DC-DC converters, your DC-AC converters, the inverters, the blah, blah, everything, they're all little disparate boxes. So one of the things, if we get to a point where somebody wants us to help them reduce the cost of an electric vehicle, would be to integrate those boxes together. You got to bring the temperatures down because they do get hot. But at the end of the day, why should I have four or five boxes this size when I could probably make it just slightly bigger and put all those boxes into one location? But that is a very, very good question. Actually, that was probably the number one question for the analysts in both London and in New York.
Okay, B. Wilson for Webb. Very interesting question here. Can you compare and contrast the weight per kilowatt hour of the Tesla 2170 pack versus the Bolt pack? And he's got some follow-ups on this, too. What do you think of the 2170, the so-called laptop batteries? You know, that used to be the 18650, now the newer one's out, the 2170.
Okay, so we've taken apart pretty much every battery system on the planet. We have not done that one because no one has requested it, no one.
Oh, because here's another question. Peter says, surely there is great industry interest in a Monroe and Associates teardown of a Tesla Model 3. Has anyone commissioned you to do a Model 3 teardown?
Okay, so if this guy could help me out, I really need some help here. Can you get me one of those? Right now, I've got every Chinese company in China, every car company wants one, and they are willing to pay almost anything. So if you can get one, please let me know, and we'll work out a deal. Yes.
Yeah, and going back to the prior one about the 2170s, let's see, he says he was most interested in comparing the current Tesla pack density to the Bolt because of the relative MPGe difference. And I'm not sure what that difference is. Mm. But he wants to know, is it battery chemistry? Is it tubular cells versus prismatic ones?
Yeah, right, cylindrical. Anyways, cylindrical cells aren't as efficient, and the reason for that is because I can't get the density. So I want to have them tighter together. That's why prismatic is a better way to go. However, cylindrical cells are cheap, 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 because all they are is a couple of, you know, it's like a big jelly roll, right? And you're done. It's wicked. It's a great idea.
So is Tesla smart for doing that then?
They were initially. But now, remember I was talking about Samsung? Samsung's figured out how to do that in a prismatic form. So like I say, the Samsung battery pack should be less money than the LG battery pack. But I can tell you, Samsung bought our evaluation of their battery pack and came back and said, thank you very much. This is because they had something internal happened there, and they needed to have an outside audit, and it was much cheaper to buy it from us than it was to have it sent out and have an audit done by somebody else. But we, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard this, but NHTSA, the EPA, CARB, they use Monroe's numbers, and We've been told we're irrefutable when it comes to, you know, how good are our numbers. So we're very, very good at costing. We didn't know how good until we started finding comparisons. Anyways, moving on.
Okay, and one last one. And this is something that you introduced the audience to several years ago. Steve B. wants to know, what the heck ever happened to Covetic aluminum? I never hear anything about it anymore.
Lawyers. It's a problem. Too many people were involved, and everybody thought they were all millionaires and stuff like that. So I haven't talked to anybody on Covetic for quite some time. The Covetic copper, the Covetic aluminum, the Covetic iron, the Covetic whatever, everything's wrapped up in lawsuits and hard feelings and stuff like that. So we have to wait another 8 years.
Oh, jeez.
And then it'll be wide open, right? Everybody will steal it. Actually, I already know that they're making Covetic materials in China all over the place. And there's some significant advantages to that stuff. So the Chinese are going to take care of it because they don't care about patents. And I know that in Germany, they've cracked the code. They know how to do it. It is what it is. And we had a DARPA project, a DARPA and a DOD project, both to make some of the stuff, or at least try and show how it could be made. And so my guess is that that the federal government, if they need it, they'll know how to make it, and they'll do whatever they want quietly, because when it comes to that kind of stuff, the government wins.
Yeah. Real good. We're going to have to wrap up unless anybody got any last-minute things.
Do you like fasteners any better than you used to?
Huh?
Do you like fasteners?
Yeah.
No.
Sandy hates nuts and bolts and screws. And
I don't hate them. I just think that that's just a sign that you're not much of an engineer. If you can figure out how to make it so that it clicks together, snaps together, if you can figure out how to design a product so that you get rid of them because you can make it all in one. You were talking about additive manufacturing. I mean, that's going to put a lot of, especially on the low volume stuff, that should put a lot of screw manufacturers, give them nightmares at night, because I can make an egg now. And actually, you know, we do a lot of things for a lot of different people, and you know, if it's low volume and it doesn't take long to figure what low volume products might be, if it's low volume and you want it rugged, like really rugged, you can't beat. And now I can make the outside shell out of titanium or something. Inside I can put plastic components. I can stop the process, add circuits. I can run gold for traces and stuff like that. I can do a lot of stuff with additive manufacturing. Actually, that building where we're in, that's called the Maker's Building. So we have that one strip on the bottom with 24,000 square feet. The rest of the building is makers. All kinds of different ways of putting things into production. So, again, where's the one in Detroit? Where's our Maker's Building in Detroit?
Well, we do have one in
Allen Park.
Allen Park, right.
Allen Park. How many people are in it? Is it as big as that thing was?
No, it's not as big as that. No way.
I think we better figure. I mean, we've been lucky, you know. Every time there's a war, somebody sinks one of our boats or blows up one of our seaports or something like that, and boom, we're in a war. And then we looks like we're losing, and then somehow we build it back up, and then we go right back to, you know, zero tech. I don't think you're going to be able to get that kind. Because of everything's speed, the speed everything's moving now, I think it'd be a good idea if we pulled up our socks and tried to figure out how we're going to keep up or get ahead of the rest of the curve. We can't sell software forever.
I totally agree with that comment, and that's a great way to end this show. Sandy Monroe, thanks so much for coming back on Out of Line After Hours. Great having you. Great discussion here.
Very good to be here. Thank you.
David Welch, thanks for having you on the show, too. Really
thanks, John. Great to be here. Great to be back.
Yeah. And Gary, you and I are just going to keep on doing this.
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Next week, perhaps.
Next week, yeah. Okay. Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Keep on keeping on.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.